They probably had more on-screen time in this movie than the other two movies.
Where it's just the two of them together?
Well, because they spend so much time, like, talking either to a radio program about their mishaps or typing on a computer to each other and not seeing each other.
Oh, that's right. You see, here's the thing, though. I've never been a big chick flicker.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. Hey, applauders, welcome to April.
This is your host of Shocked and Applaud, Lydia Malcolm, and
Naomi McQuaid, and
Jen McQuaid.
Sweet. You guys are here for April. You made it through March. You are now in the month where you're probably working on your taxes, maybe listening to this podcast in the background.
Yeah, take your mind off of it. You didn't mean to spend that much.
Yeah.
Come with us, children, to 1990.
30 years ago.
Oh, don't say it like that. Oh no, 30 years ago. Okay.
Yeah.
The young ones listening, like 30 years ago is not that long ago, but it was forever ago.
Yeah. I mean, when you get to be like 30 years old or over, just like ask yourself, was it long ago?
It really wasn't.
No.
But you're halfway through if you're me.
You're like a third of the way through if you expect to live past 90.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
I don't. Okay, that's too dark. So, guys, we are going to review Joe versus the Volcano.
This is a movie that this is probably a movie you've never heard of, which is hilarious because it has Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan.
Classic power couple from Hollywood.
This is like the first like somewhat romantic movie they do together.
It's the first of three.
Mm-hmm.
Could you name the other two for me, just in case
I'm ignoring? Turning my pages in my notes, because I totally wrote it down. Oh, off the top of my head, they were also in Sleepless in Seattle in 1993.
Right.
And in You've Got Mail in 1998.
Right.
They probably had more on-screen time in this movie than the other two movies.
Where it's just the two of them together?
Well, because they spend so much time, like, talking either to a radio program about their mishaps or typing on a computer to each other and not seeing each other.
Oh, that's right. You see, here's the thing, though. I've never been a big chick flicker.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. I've never been much into romantic comedies. And I've probably said that about every episode that has had any kind of romantic leaning. I've seen You've Got Mail several times, and I know of Sleepless in Seattle because from the area, and so I probably even watched it once, but I cannot remember having watched this film before, like, today.
You probably haven't. This is not a movie that really gets a lot of promotion. Two of the executive producers, for example, are Steven Spielberg and Kathleen Kennedy. Now, Steven Spielberg, household name for most houses, but Kathleen Kennedy, most of you, if you've seen, like, what was it, the last Star Wars trilogy, she was one of the executive producers on all three of those films.
Oh.
Yeah.
I would not have been able to pick her name out of a lineup.
I know. But she's got some cred. So I think she was also an executive producer on the Temple of Doom.
Mm.
God bless.
Yeah.
And this is an Amblin Entertainment thing. So that's Spielberg before he went into DreamWorks and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, if it didn't have... here's the thing. Lydia led us down this path. And I'm cool with that because Lord knows we've looked up from the piles that I've placed before her to try to make sense of it. And I'm not saying any pronouncements over this film right this second, but I was led to this movie by you, having known it probably... I knew it existed. I had no ire to go towards it anyway, but like when you suggested we do it, I was like, okay, let's do it. And here we are. And that's my story.
I will give you nothing but pretense before we dive into this film, because applauders, you do not have to watch this film. Just listen to us rant about it. Everybody who practically worked on this is, you know, off on other excursions. They've moved on with their life. You do not need to rent this. If it's on Amazon Prime, just give it a pass, because you do not need to divulge into this movie.
Now here's I'm going to counter you on that, because if you listen to us go through this entire thing, all five fully sized sheets of my notes, and you are scrolling endlessly through yours, and you get to the end and you're like, I kind of want to see it. I mean, be shocked, applaud, do either. Like, make your own decisions, because not unlike Meg Ryan, I do what I want.
Sorry, I just had Cartman go through my head. I do what I want.
Probably sound more like Cartman than Meg Ryan.
Okay, so Naomi just gave her background on the film. My background is that I have watched this film since I was probably a preteen. It was definitely something that I saw on network television. I remember it because there's a scene later on where, like, it never was showed on TV. And I remember being like, oh yeah, that wouldn't have been shown on TV because it's talking about prosthetic testicles. It was one of those movies when I was younger, like, beat you over the head with so many things that I couldn't help but just notice it and, like, be like, okay, this is just, like, there's a level of repetition here. Mm-hmm. There's, like, a specific style that they're kind of going for.
Yeah.
And it definitely was one of those films where when I saw it, there was an aspect of filmmaking that I really got into.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of like The NeverEnding Story, but The NeverEnding Story holds up so much better than this for reasons that we will get into.
This, what kept shocking me, and I guess I was playing this game last night called Mystique, I think, and not to try to explain a board game too hard in the middle of a podcast about movies, but I was supposed to pick these picture cards for players to guess who done it, like who, where, and when. With what? And so I had to give them these random cards. Well, I was playing with a couple people I don't hang out with super much. And so, like, I was trying to pick cards that would lead them to guess the character or the place or the thing. But the images didn't connect very well. So, like, I was handing them these random things. And I would think things like, oh, you know, this is the same color scheme as the card I'm trying to have them guess. And you're trying to send a psychic message to these people as a ghost. I know. Sorry. It's a pretty good board game, I got to say. But, like, I struggled the first few rounds because I was trying to communicate this larger idea, and this movie rang so true to the board game that I struggled three quarters of the way through last night that I was like, yeah, no, you're sending me pictures, you're giving me a big scope,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know the context, and you're not offering any context, and then you make this big pronouncement, and I'm supposed to be like, yes, very deep, much wow,
yeah,
so learned.
This is like baby's first pretentious film.
Yep, I would. Mm-hmm. It's a little pretentious.
Just a little?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. It came out during my parents', like, reawakening. This is around, this is just before they got a divorce. This is like when they were like, I'm an adult and I got kids and I'm doing the thing. And this was, these kinds of characters were their fantasies, I'm pretty sure. I mean, mm-hmm. like, not, maybe not speaking specifically for both of my parents, but I could definitely get the feeling that this is the era where they're like, yeah, I'm right. a successful or newly liberated and I'm going to find and this is going to fulfill my, mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was kind of like Office Space in the beginning part of it, too. For me, it was like, it's got this, I'm stuck in a rut at a dead-end job.
Mm.
Yeah, it's very expositional about the boomer experience.
Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm. And so, because now we both want to talk about the beginning, because I totally want to get into that.
Yeah.
Shall we start with our title sequence?
Yeah, I just want to make one note. So, fun fact, the movie released March 9th, 1990, and we are recording March 8th, 2020.
Oh, I think that's cool. We're about coincidences like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that is, like, pretty much, like, 30 years to the date.
Man, Shudder.
30 years.
Gosh, you're so close to death now.
Your life is meaningless.
Oh, no.
Okay, sorry. Don't mean to derail us. To the plot.
People say man is made out of mud.
Do you remember what, like, shows up? There's, like, this orchestra kind of playing.
Yeah, it's a little lead-in where they're tuning themselves.
Yeah.
That's just so romantic and hits my brain so good. And is, now that you mention it, non sequitur for the rest of the film.
It reminds me of when you go to, like, a theater that has an orchestra.
Yeah.
You hear that as, like, right before they actually start the production yeah. because they're tuning it.
Yeah.
So it takes me back to, like, Decatur Drama Society.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but there's, like, when the music does start, there's, like, this opening line that says, once upon a time, there was a guy named Joe who had a very lousy job.
And here's the thing for title cards. There are only, like, two times it happens. And mm-hmm. this is one.
Yeah.
And so it's like the Shrek reading the book opening where he uses it for toilet paper.
Completely unnecessary.
Yeah. I just felt like, I mean, okay, we can talk about it more in depth, but this is really an adult fantasy film.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't have much not too many instances of fantastic things happening.
Right. It's like a bedtime story for an adult.
Yeah, I'd go with that.
It's got some surrealism to it for sure. It's sort of a fisheye lens experience of looking into the world of Joe.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I agree with Lydia's theory that everything in this film is through the lens of Joe.
So, Applauders, as you're listening to us, I want you to imagine that everything that we're about to say is coming through one specific character's eyesight, one specific character's mindset, not just because he's the protagonist, but, well, actually, yeah, it's the exact reason is because he's the protagonist. We're going to be looking through everything as though it's how Joe sees the world.
Yes, because as much as I love the Oatmeal's perception of Bella's character in Twilight as pants, he went through, it's really, there's a video online about it, but that Bella is so devoid of character that you can just step into her and be her in the books. And that's why found it so compelling, because it really didn't matter who you were, because you could be pants.
Because she was such a nothing character, she didn't have any personality.
Yes. However, this is a character played by Tom Hanks, who is incomparable. Mm-hmm. So he definitely comes with character and he comes with all of this substance, but the film, I think, overall is perceived differently if you, even as a female, to like place yourself as Joe.
Right. So just kind of like keep that in mind, that the protagonist is more than likely what we're seeing everything through. It puts the movie into context if you see it as just like, this is how a straight male white guy is going to see the rest of the world, because it's going to make sense later on. So just keep that back in your brain holes.
I've been reading some books, and I have had the phrase magical white boy nonsense going through my head every time that something super special happens to them, because they need to feel they are special. And I'm like, yes.
Mood.
Everybody is. If you think of all of your favorite, I'm so sorry for the rant, and we haven't even started. We got to the title card, guys. But if you think of some of the best media out there, a young man who didn't know how special he was until he was discovered to be super special, and then he became the specialist special, and he can do all the things, and now he's got friends who also are special, but not as special as him. And
I feel like this is an entire rant against Harry Potter.
Or Luke Skywalker.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or, like, anybody. Like, it's.
I might have titled this movie Okay Boomer.
Trying to keep it down for the neighbors.
I'm sorry. Oh, look, it says Once Upon a Time there was a guy named Joe, and he had a very bad job.
Yeah. Also, the default font style for the film is Comic Sans.
No.
I mean, I don't know if it is. It just looks like Comic Sans, so that's what it is in my head.
Okay.
Yeah, that should tell you all you need to know for the movies. Have a great day, Applauders. I guess we're done. Yeah. Okay, never mind.
Let's cue a upbeat, a fairly fast tempo version of
Tennessee. Ernie Ford.
He wrote 16 Tons.
Right. This is a cover of it.
Yes. This is one of my dad's favorite songs, so I've got it memorized. Mm-hmm. But this redo of it, I'm like, maybe that's got to get in the mix, because it's a little saucy.
Yeah, it's a little slightly upbeat. Uh-huh. It's a little bit higher of a tempo. It's a little bit modern.
Yes.
Modern in air quotes, because this is a 30-year-old movie.
Oh, my God. But what we're about to describe is so visually heavy, and it's doubly heavy if you have, I don't know, say a crappy factory job.
Yeah.
Mood. I'm so sorry. That's our new thing right this second. Ignore it. Jen, edit it out.
Don't.
But like, so we get, some people say a man is, except it's jazzy, so it's like, some people say a man is made out of mud.
Yeah.
And then, so we see a foot come out of an open car door.
It's Tom Hanks' foot, and it just comes right out of the door of the car, and it lands square in a puddle.
You know, in the puddle, in the way that it goes over the edge of the shoe and into your sock, and you know you're going to be feeling that all day.
Yeah.
And then there's an electrical guitar with the foot.
Oh.
It just...
you see, now it cuts back and forth between Joe's walk into work and the conditions thereupon. So they're in a muddy parking lot. The cars are stacked, poorly parked in this very geometric fashion that's just like a grid.
It's not an efficient parking job. This is meant to be purely visual.
Uh-huh.
See, this is like Joe feeling like, you know, even in the parking lot, he's boxed in. Even as he's walking into his office, he feels boxed in and crowded. Mm-hmm. And this is the first montage I mean, I love montages for opening scenes. That totally makes sense.
Yeah, it saves a lot of expositional time.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me super crazy when people drop litter on the ground, though. And so the fact that it's a dirt and mud parking lot and there's garbage and you watch at least one or two people physically drop trash. And I'm mm-hmm. like, you're trash.
Yeah. And it's just this muddy parking lot. It's not even paved parking lot.
No, no.
Yeah. Do you remember the building that he was walking into, the name of the company he works for?
You know what? I looked twice, but I'm nearsighted and it's a very dark scene. So I couldn't tell what it said.
American Panoscope, a subsidiary of ACHI, Long Island City, New York, home of the rectal probe and 50 years in petroleum jelly. That's just like, okay, so there's like a series of scenes where you see people walking and there's like these signs as Joe's walking along. Yeah, you see him pass a sign or like come up as a sign is saying something. And so I wrote all of them down.
Do tell in succession, what do they say?
I did.
Oh, I thought that was all on the front sign. I was like, I remember reading those, but I don't remember it being on the big sign out front where it looks like a giant face.
No, these are just like tattered throughout the entire opening.
The opening is really fantastic if you want to feel really sad.
Yeah.
In this whole opening scene, I got really strong The Jungle by Upton Sinclair vibes. It's a book, I don't know if there's probably a movie rendition of it, but it's about working conditions in the 1800s in a meatpacking facility.
Oh.
And how like rats are dying and people are dying and you didn't get enough money and you owed all the money to the company store, which is mentioned in 16 Tons, where you live and work in nearly the same place. And so your pay never covered all of your rent and your food, but you had to keep working for the factory to pay off the bill.
Mm-hmm.
So like, they're putting in all this work and there's like zero return. Mm-hmm. And it's just this thing is literally draining your life away.
Right.
And he definitely looks like that.
Yeah. There's a few metaphors that they kind of just hit you over the head with. First, the first metaphor that we see is Joe going into the gate of the entire complex.
Uh-huh.
And he like doesn't lift his foot up all the way and he like scrapes the edge of his shoe over it. And all I can think while he's like looking at the bottom of his shoe, seeing the sole of it just flap.
Yeah.
I'm just like, dude, you're holding up the line. It's not that end of the world. You make $300 a week.
$300 a week.
Seriously. And then there's this moment where he, like, passes through it and he just raises up his hands to the sky like, why, God? Why?
Yeah, definitely. And then there's this crooked path that is in the shape of a lightning bolt.
Yeah.
As they walk to a building with a lightning bolt on it.
We don't want to forget the very obvious metaphor.
Oh, yes.
There are people walking. There is a shot of the ground, and on that ground, you have this one daisy.
It managed to force its way through the concrete and say, dang it, I'm here to be loved.
And you see these feet stepping on around it. None of them steps on it except for one lady's shoe.
A lady's shoe, guys.
I'm pretty sure, like, going back to our last podcast of Harold and Maude, my note was the obvious metaphor where someone's stepping on a daisy, and I'm like, no! Harold!
Mine just says, that daisy! And then I drew a sad face.
I know. Oh. Okay.
So he walks into the building and it's down into a pit. Like, I say a pit. He's walking down into this factory. So the top seems very much like a facade because everything's below ground.
Mm-hmm.
And he's walking in like a trench coat, right? But then it cuts to all these guys in jumpsuits, and my notes are like, welding? What does welding have to do with a rectal probe? And then they cut to a picture of a metal rectal probe, and I was like, oh, what times we live in. Oh, you'd have to buy that special on the internet. They wouldn't mass produce that anymore. But then there's shots of guys dumping petroleum that... So gross.
It's so gross.
This guy's got this big lever with all these jaggedy teeth at the bottom, and he's like pumping it to get petroleum jelly in his like, 5-gallon buckets? It's not okay.
It's a living.
But I'm like, why is he wearing a trench coat if he's going to go put stuff in a bucket?
Right. Well, it's because Joe doesn't actually work in the factory.
Right.
It's because Joe works in the advertising office.
And my notes go, advertising? Question mark, exclamation mark.
Yeah. And he walks in and we hear like typewriting in the background and we hear his boss in the background on the phone.
Yes. He's like, Harry, listen to me. If I had said that, it wouldn't be true.
I never said that. Yeah.
Like, he can get the job, but can he do the job?
You only hear this one-sided conversation with his boss on the phone with someone. And all he says are like these random lines that are constantly repeated.
This is the thing. When I watched it the first time, I was like, oh my God. Have you ever played a video game that had a plot line with people who can talk? and you don't leave the area that you've entered with an NPC like quick enough. And so they just go on repeat and you're like, oh man, I got to check this for loot boxes. So you walk to some random corner and it's like, Harry, he can get the job, but can he do the job? And you're like, oh, you know what I should do really quick? I should open up my inventory and make sure that this is something, something. Harry, I never said that. If I said that, it would be true. I never said that.
In Office Space, when he walks in for the first time, there's a lady in the background answering phone calls, and I can't remember how she starts it, but every time she says, just a moment, and then she just keeps answering this phone call, multiple phone calls, and she's just placing them on hold, and she just says, just a moment. It's the exact same kind of deal.
Kind of going back to my original point of seeing that through the eyes of Joe Watari, W-A-T-U-R-I, Watari.
Yeah.
Now, he has an award for the artificial testicle prototype, but what is interesting is I looked up that surname, and according to forebearers.io, it has origins in Kenya, India, and Indonesia. So it's kind of this weird place where you got a white guy who is being like...
He totally looks like Nixon, by the way.
Yeah. The Mr. Watari is played by Dan Hedaya. And he's one of those like actors where you're like, I've seen that guy. I've seen that guy in so many things. You can't place his name, but he's generally like pretty fabulous. But it's like, I don't know. It's just it's so weird that it's such an odd name that it's like, why would you give a white guy this name?
I want it to mean something like Jack in Hindi.
Yeah.
Anyways, so what we've skipped over is that he's walked in past the typist. This whole scene, you realize that he doesn't like the lighting and that there's this constant buzzing and his boss is always yelling and this chick is typing. She's got the worst posture I have ever seen for typing. You know how they harp on you to like sit back straight, feet flat on the floor, arms like raised at the elbow? Like she is under the desk. She is like hunched over the keys and she's just slapping them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm doing a little hand motion, guys. Anyway, so he makes his crappy cup of coffee and he walks back to his desk, which happens to be around the corner in the library.
He has his own office, his own side office.
Yeah.
He's super important.
He's so important. I bet he makes at least $300 a week.
Yeah. He like passes by this pipe that says don't touch.
Yes, this is a main
pipe, main line.
Something like that.
Yeah. Anyways, he goes over to his desk and he decides to go ahead and pull out this kitschy kind of lamp.
It's a full-size table lamp, guys.
Yeah.
That he has stored in a filing cabinet.
Yeah, so he takes it out of the filing cabinet, puts it up. What kind of a lamp is it? It is a lamp that has this, like, when you turn it on, it has music playing and the shade turns around. It's a really interesting concept for a lamp.
The stem of the lamp is a lady.
Mm-hmm. And
in a white dress, I might point out.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And it plays the theme of the movie.
It also has the lampshade has pictures of a tropical paradise and a mountain that happens to be exploding and happens to have a path on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's crooked, like a lightning bolt.
Yeah. Beats you over the head.
I like that he smacks the fluorescent light above him to make it go off because he just can't stand the fluorescence.
Mm-hmm.
Now that I work in a place that has fluorescent light all the time, it really does make your eyeballs want to bleed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then his coworker comes in. This is the first time we meet Dee Dee, who is played by Meg Ryan.
Yes. She has a vaguely Harley Quinn-ish. They're in New York, you know. She's got a vaguely Quinn-ish accent. Meg Ryan doesn't play her as vapid, but she does play her as distracted and maybe not the smartest.
A little bit mousy, maybe.
Yeah, definitely. And timid.
Yeah.
But not like, I'm not talking like librarian timid, but like beaten by the system timid.
Yeah. She's like, now each one of these gets 5 magazines.
Well, I only have 12.
Oh, okay.
What? I'll talk to him. Like it all.
So Mr. Watari comes in and it starts berating Joe for not having the supplies orders. But Joe reminded him like 3 weeks ago and then 2 weeks ago.
You said that I wasn't allowed to order them.
Yeah.
It's too complicated a system for you to use.
It probably isn't. But it's like what is it? Like Watari's trying to make this all about how Joe isn't trying hard enough and he's not like being a good employee. And and Watari really wants Joe to be assistant manager. He's like, I want to make you assistant manager. And he's like, no, you don't. Because if you did, you would have ordered the magazines when he had asked you for them 3 weeks ago. And like, it ends with him saying, now make sure that you ship those things out. And he's like, if you'll order the magazines.
So then he just whips around and he's like, put away that lamp.
Yeah.
Like, he's got to control the... Bad management does that. Like, mm-hmm. they get a shortcoming pointed out to them, and then they have to go on the offensive, and then they have to, like, discipline their employee about something that has nothing to do with the issue at hand.
Mm-hmm. I know that. I know that feeling. That is definitely a bad manager. I mean, it's not like we didn't know when Joe put up his hat, and then the hat rack fell apart, and it wasn't just, like, on one hook. So then Dee Dee comes in. She's like, why do you let him talk to you like that? And there, this moment is just like Dee Dee asks Joe a question. He answers it. And then Dee Dee asks him another question.
Yeah.
And like it ends with, what's wrong with you? And he's like, I don't know. And he puts up the palms of his hands.
During his first interaction with his boss, he did tell him that he had a doctor's appointment later that day.
Yeah.
So he covers his hands, like you say, with his palms to his eyeballs. And then he's like pressing in. And then he pulls them away and he's got these really red eyes. Mm-hmm. Like he's really been pressing on his eyes.
The scene cuts from him in the office to him in the doctor's office saying, Mr. Banks, the doctor will see you now.
One of the few women not played by Meg Ryan in this film.
Seriously.
And he's in this super white room that's got these dots on these panels.
Mm-hmm.
He opens the door to the doctor's office and it's this richly paneled library. And it looks so different. We've only had these very cold, flickering, staticky, really cool colored, disgusting areas. And now all of a sudden we're in this opulence.
Well, if you think about it, like the doctor's receptionist is probably just as put upon and beaten down as Joe and everybody else in Watari's office.
Huh.
I mean, even Watari is actually in the office with them. He's just making it seem like he's like more important than them. What is it when people start talking about how, oh, I'm middle class, despite the fact that they don't have anything in their savings, they're still working from paycheck to paycheck. Mm-hmm. They still see themselves as being middle class, but they're really not. They're lower to...
People have terrible self-perception. There are people who make $200,000 a year who are like, I'm middle class.
Yeah.
I'm like, No. How's that ramen tasting?
Yeah. So...
not that I would ever give up eating ramen, guys. It's going to be what kills me. If it's not a volcano.
The volcano's going to spit you right back out. Oh, sorry.
Don't!
Anyways.
Okay, so who's that doctor? Who's that doctor? Who's that doctor?
It's Robert Stack.
Yeah.
that's the Unsolved Mysteries guy, guys.
Yeah, my skin like totally puckered. I was like, ah, my childhood is going to tell me about a dead guy or some child who got stolen because they didn't shut their window. Like, he totally fed into my paranoia as a kid.
So that's the doctor that Joe goes to see. So the doctor asked Joe some questions, and Joe said he used to be a fireman, but he quit because he kept getting sick.
He sounds like he has PTSD.
Yeah,
a little bit.
So I wrote in my notes, like, it's just some unchecked PTSD, but it's more like it's not really taken care of. Like, he hasn't gone to a therapist. He's going and looking for a physical illness.
Yeah, that's the hypochondria showing up. But straight up, it hurts. It stings a little bit to have burnt out on a highly emotional, highly physical, slightly dangerous job, and then go to, like, this menial, abundantly meaningless job and have it be like, yeah, remember when everything meant something, and now... You just make garbage.
Mm-hmm. So the doctor then informs Joe that he has a brain cloud and that Joe is expected to die in about 6 months. So
he's like, I can't do the voice. Jen, maybe you can, but like, you're habitually fearful. And that's led you to have all of these illnesses. They're all inside your head. But you know what? You really do have an illness and it's brain cloud.
Yeah, he explains it away saying that, well, there's nothing physically wrong with you. The only reason why we found this is because you insisted on so many tests.
Yes, and I love how Tom sits down and he's just like, I knew it. I didn't know it, but I knew it. And he just like does all these swirlies around his head. And it's like, oh, honey.
Okay. So like the first time I saw this, I remember thinking, okay, this is kind of like a campy movie. And so when they bring in like something like a brain cloud, I'm like, okay, this is definitely like some kind of whimsical, campy movie. That's the tone they're going for. It's just so out there. It's so far-fetched. I mean, this isn't something that I'm supposed to take seriously.
In Office Space, the thing that changes the main character is going to see a therapist. And then that therapist dies mid...
like session?
Yeah, mid-session, but it's because he's like brainwashing. Or not brainwashing, he's
hypnotizing.
The main character.
Oh, I remember that vaguely. It's been so long.
All I'm saying is this is Office Space 0.5.
Well, at this point in the movie, I call this the jungle vibes with Willy Wonka style, so...
If you have any information leading to the appearance of Brain Cloud...
Brilliant. I love it.
So... The doctor recommends Joe go on a vacation, and Joe's just like, I don't have any money in savings. I spent it all on doctors.
He's like, well, you could go get a second opinion. And I'm like, same problem, bro.
Doesn't have any money. He only makes $300 a week.
Which is why, only $300. That's what, so now he's dying and everything sucks. And now they start playing Old Man River.
And Joe just like goes right out the building. And then you see the camera pan away from him. And there's this lady walking a dog. And he's just
it's
like,
a Great Dane. It's bigger than she is. Mm-hmm.
I think we see like two more Great Danes
you
later
do.
On.
I yeah. counted.
Yeah. And he like just goes down to pet the dog. And then he like gives the dog a hug because he just learned that he's dying.
And then he stands up and he gives the lady a hug. And mm-hmm. she's like, oh, okay. And then she just walks along.
Yeah. So, and then he gets into his car and he drives away.
Gotta go back to work.
Yeah. Watari's on the phone.
Wait, I was like, what does he walk past when he walks back into work?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So before he goes back into the building, he walks past a crushed daisy.
And he gets down. He does a squat. He like pulls up this daisy and he straightens it up and then he spreads out its petals so that it can be as much of a daisy as it could be. I think one of the petals falls off or something like that. Like, it's really pathetic. And then, like, and then I think, is this another time when he looks at the sky? No, he just looks up all grizzled, like, mm-hmm.
Well, another beautiful thing crushed by the industry of man.
It's so sad. He walks back into work, and now yeah. Watari is screaming
yeah,
into again, the phone.
Saying the same thing. I'm not asking if he can get the job. I'm asking if he can do the job. Anyways.
It's not what I said. Yeah. But I said it wouldn't be true.
I never said that.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
And Joe, like, goes to put his hat on the hat rack, and then he's just like, fuck it.
Yeah, no, the hat rack is still broken from when it broke in the first scene.
Yeah.
He walks over to Dee Dee's waste bin, and he just chucks the hat in there. He's like, yeah. Screw that hat. And then he, like, looks at Dee Dee.
Yeah. And then he goes and picks up the arm of a mannequin.
No, he pulls out her paper.
Oh, yeah.
He wiggles it in her face. And I'm like, she did nothing to you, bro. And then he walks around to random, like, the only other guy who gets no name and no lines. And yeah. he's just like, at that guy. Then he crumples it up, walks back a few feet. And then he Kobe's it. Is that too soon? Into the trash bin next to mm-hmm. random dude. And then he turns around and there's all of these prosthetics, all of these product things. And I don't know why in a rectal, I mean, I suppose the alternative would be much more entertaining to me as a gross human being, but there's just a random mannequin arm and like a head that's got a big old weird open mouth, and he just starts playing with the arm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he kind of like, what is it? I turned to Naomi as we're rewatching it, and I'm like, Tom Hanks at his most Nick Cage.
Absolutely. He starts to arm wrestle the dismembered arm.
Yeah.
And the arm almost wins, not gonna lie.
Yeah, yeah.
But then he wins.
Yeah, and then he takes the arm over to Watari's.
Watari's like, I gotta get off the phone. I got something going on.
Yeah, and then Tom Hanks takes the arm over and like he goes, so Watari is like artificial testicle.
Prosthetic testicles.
He has an award for it. And it's just like these two golden like holders of these like gelatin.
They look like little glass orbs on top of like a plastic sports trophy that happens to come up in two little sconces, kind of like a candelabra.
Thank you. But they're like removable.
Yes, so, the balls aren't set in there. You see him adjust them earlier in the film so that when Hanks comes by with this arm and is like slapping his papers and like he drags it over the statue and these balls go flying.
Yeah.
Guy like has to grab them. He caught them both. I thought that was quite good.
Yeah.
And he like re-puts them back in and Joe is like flipping, flopping all of his stuff all over his desk and he's like, eventually he like slaps him in the face with the prosthetic arm.
Yeah.
Is that before or after he hits the phone and he's just like, hello, hello, but he can't pick up the phone.
Yeah, he like just does the phone and then gets him in the face and then he lets it go. Then he goes back into his office and
hey, that's company property!
And Mr. Watari grabs that arm, goes right into that office, and you see the shot of Watari like holding the arm straight at Joe in this accusatory kind of way.
Yes, I think the thumb is down and it's like, with the weird pinky up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Joe just like starts cleaning out his desk, saying he's quits and everything. And Watari's like, well, fine, I could go ahead and you know, replace you. You're just fine. And
easy to replace.
Yeah, so Joe starts pulling out these, like, books, like Robinson Crusoe.
I wrote down them, all three of them.
Yes. Do you want to say them?
You forgot it. Go for it.
He pulls out three books. Robinson Crusoe, Romeo and Juliet, and The Odyssey. On the nose a little bit much.
Yeah, if you were to put those three books in a blender, add 2.5 quarts of plain white unflavored yogurt, and you were to then put in 2 cups of milk and 1/4 of a packet, nope, let's be generous, 1/2 a packet of vanilla pudding, and then you set that on blend, and then you put that through a strainer.
Added Nick Cage.
And then, well, you'd have to only a pinch of Nick Cage. For that one scene.
Yeah.
And then once you put it through the strainer, right, you take that concentrate, you add 2 liters of lukewarm water to it, mix it together, and that's this film.
I love food metaphors.
Everything's a food metaphor.
And then Joe, like, heads out the door. He tells Dee Dee that he quits, and she's like, you leaving?
But, like, the way he quits, though, when he's just like, suck, 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 suck.
Oh, he, like, makes this big speech throughout the entire thing about how it's, like, you know, this.
He was just going to leave. And he got to the door, and he starts muttering under his breath. And Watari, his boss, is like, you got something to say? And he's like, he verbalizes it. He goes, I got to say something. And he turns back around and launches into, like, the next 5 minutes of the film, Lydia.
Yeah.
He goes full Jerry Maguire.
Yes, he's like, he quits in such an epic fashion. He's like, these lights suck. Your coffee sucks. Everything about this sucks, 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 sucks.
Yeah, the lights are like, you know, he looks up to the lights. He's like, just imagine Tom Hanks trying his best to do a Nick Cage impression.
I'm fully behind you on this. He calls his now former place of work a used rubber. I didn't believe it the first time. I wrote it down the second.
I do not remember that.
Yeah, it's a kind of a throwaway at the end of one of the sentences.
Okay.
But he says it. And
yeah.
That's when the boss says, there are ladies present. And he goes, don't you know I know that? Oh, and then he like flatters the crap out of her. You see her go from like, oh, Seymour to, oh, Seymour.
Yeah.
He's like,
literal Mr. J, since his name is Joe.
Oh, yeah. Which is a Harley Quinn reference, which doesn't make sense when you're thinking about Ellen Green, which now we're back here.
Everything just, like, goes back to itself.
It's a long and winding lightning-shaped path. That didn't work either. But
he eventually gets through with his rant, and then he just dramatically leaves. But he sticks his head back in and says, hey, Dee Dee. She's like, yeah, Joe? He's like, have dinner with me. Yeah, okay.
So they go out to dinner, and it's not okay. This dinner is not okay. I've been on several dates, okay, mostly with the same person. And the way he goes to this, like, if someone said it to you with any intonation that was not exactly Tom Hanks, it would not be okay. It would be what I have dubbed in my questions, in my notes as serial killer questions.
Yeah. Dee Dee does look uncomfortable at one point. She says, oh, a lot of things scare me right now, you. And he's like, why? And he's just like talking about how he used to be alive. And he used to be on fire. And he used to have gumption. And, you know. And
what scares you?
Dun, dun, dun.
Like what? Oh, at the end. Okay. Sorry. If you cut this out, this is fine. But in the last scene, he goes, and I'm going to leave you here. And what could be worse than that? That's when he leaves.
I would like to note that Meg Ryan pointed out in the DVD extra that Dee Dee is modeled after her dog.
Lucille. Her dog Lucille, who's been dead for a long time now. Movies and animals over 20 years ago are dead. Yeah. That was so sad.
And so Joe gets up during their date, goes over to this band and tells them to go ahead and come over and play him a song. And he's like, I just asked the band to come over and play us a song that's going to make our hearts swell. And it's like, there's some writing in this script that just is like, maybe it worked back in 1990.
Well, look, when he kept saying in his rant as he was leaving the office that I sold my soul for $300 a week.
That's why we kept bringing it up earlier.
Yeah, probably worth mentioning now, but like 5 minutes ago now.
Yeah.
So, but this tactic with the mariachi band, it works. Like, she's into it. She's like, I have no idea what he's talking about, but he's so full of life. He has this thing that I lack, so I'm totally into it. And then they walk in. They do the ferry with the Rainbow City behind them. All the buildings are lit up different. That's not how cities work, but that's fine.
Well, while they're going back to the table, Joe actually like reaches out his hand, and his hand is open and hers is closed. And I only bring that up because that's kind of important later on when.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
When she slides her closed fist into his open palm, it just made me, I mean, it's, that sounds way grosser, but mm-hmm. it made me think of all the times I've tried to hold my cat's paw. And she's not down. She don't like it. She don't want to hold hands with me. That's not how kittens do.
Yeah. And so they go back to Joe's place.
They take the Staten Island ferry and they're right. like standing there looking all awkward and cute. And then they cut to the front of his apartment building that also has weirdly, strangely colored lights. Like mm-hmm. everybody in your neighborhood has like a blue and a green and a yeah. yellow and whatever.
And they go up together and then they start making out after yeah. they get into the apartment.
Yeah, they go for it.
And, you know, to Joe's credit, he tells Dee Dee, you know, I've just been told that I have 5 or 6 months to live. So, like, before they get really into it, because Dee Dee, like, makes the first move. She's just all over him.
She goes, what's different about you? Mm-hmm. And she's, like, kissing all up on him. She goes down his chest a little bit. Like, it's going down, or somebody is. And
sorry. Did I just... Because I apologize, Jen.
You grossed me out. That's okay.
Sorry.
Okay. But she's like, what's different about you? And he goes, oh, I got told that I only have 4 to 5 months to live. And she's like, oh, and she's still into it. And then all of a sudden the words register and she's like, what?
Yeah. And it's like at that point, he's like kissing on her as she's registering it. Mm-hmm. And as soon as she has any reservations about it, he stops and he's just like, I would really like you to stay tonight.
She goes, I want to go. And he only takes off his jacket and mm-hmm. says, I really want you to stay here tonight. But he doesn't move from the spot he's standing for the rest of the scene. Oh, except he steps maybe once towards the door, once she leaves the door.
Right. But, like, you don't see him doing – she's doing a lot of this moving. Like, the way that they're positioned, it's Dee Dee, Tom Hanks, and then the door. So, like, uh-huh. he's positioned between her and the door.
Yeah.
So he could very easily be in, like, this power play uh-huh. to keep her there. And he does it. He just is, like – it's very much showing – you know, in 1990, it's just very much showing this level of consent – or like a willingness to say, okay, it's very obvious she doesn't want it, so I'm going to not move
yes.
from the yeah. spot.
And she does eventually leave, and then she opens the door, and he has this moment of hope, and she's like, I forgot my purse.
Yeah.
Shut the door. I'm gonna make this sad for a second, though. How weak is it that our praise is that he's not a rapist?
Like, that's the best part of the movie.
Yay, Tom Hanks!
Yay!
That's not the end of the podcast. Although if our last dying words were Tom Hanks isn't a rapist, not the worst last words.
It's just, it's like, if that is like, congratulations, you are doing the like the bare minimum to be decent.
Right?
And we are just like super happy about that. It's kind of a weird place to be in.
I think it should be an example in our society that you don't get to grab a woman's arm and be like, no, be with me, because that's unacceptable. But it's very easy as a storyteller to put it in there to be like, no, they're passionate. They want them to stay. And I'm like, yeah. No, even if you really want to be with somebody, if they don't want to be with you, you have to let that be what it is.
Right. Watching this again, it reminds me of that moment in an Android movie with Harrison Ford, and he's like killing replicants.
Blade Runner.
Yeah. So there's this moment in Blade Runner where like the love interest is like trying to make a break for the door, and he like fully stops her from doing it. And he like, it's really gross. It's just like very.
I just totally sneered at Lydia, but it was more about yeah. Harrison Ford than it was about.
Right. I mean, it's the whole, you know, like he's not letting her leave. Mm-hmm. And that was a movie that was probably like a few years before this. So it's not too far different. It's not too far removed. And like this scene just feels so much better at the very end. Mm-hmm. And even though she's like, I forgot my bag. She's barely coming into the back in. She's just grabbing it and going. And he doesn't like grab after her. He just mm-hmm. stays in place.
That's the truth of it.
Yeah. So
good on you.
Yeah, so...
Guy who wrote it, directed it.
Appreciate that. There were some other things you could have done a little bit better, but...
We're going to give you props where props is due.
Yeah, yeah. This is what I like about our podcast. We talk about, you know, the shocking moments, but we also talk about the applauding moments.
Yeah.
Moments to applaud. This is a moment to applaud.
Good on you, William.
Yeah.
Whose other two names I don't remember?
John Patrick Shanley.
It was William Patrick Shanley. No, John. Because I... Okay.
Anyways.
No. Okay.
Next morning.
My only other note is that if for $300 a week, he has a big apartment.
I don't know. Like later we see his apartment and it looks pretty run down.
I know, but square footage is a lot more to do the maintenance.
Okay.
Sometimes.
All right.
Depending on, he's in the city or Staten Island or whatever.
Next morning.
You know this is the 1990s because he let a stranger in to talk.
Yeah. He's playing his ukulele and then Lloyd Bridges shows up. And this is Samuel Greenamore, who owns a company that makes superconductors. Also, during this entire scene, we see this like weird shape in the wall.
Mm-hmm. It happens to be jagged in shape.
Almost looks like a lightning bolt.
Yeah. You know what I would say? It definitely has a lightning bolt essence.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the exact same shape as the walkway, the logo. Mm-hmm. And the third thing, because comedy comes in threes.
This image shows up like several times.
Yeah, over and over again. So he decides to hatch his harebrained scheme at our poor, dear, much loved.
I know we haven't really discussed it much, but Lloyd Bridges has a duck-headed cane.
Oh, and yeah.
This is the second appearance of a mallard or some kind of duck in the movie.
Yes, behind Hank's in the doctor's office, there was a hearth because it's this crazy office and there's a duck on it. And it's in there while the doctor's telling him about his brain cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And now dude knocks on the door. It's got a window and he holds up, like, I don't know why, but he like holds up his cane and it happens to have a duck head on it.
Right.
He's like, are you Joe?
Yeah. And Lloyd Bridges talks about how he owns this company and he makes superconductors and he needs the specific mineral from this one island. He needs it in order to create his superconductors.
Yes. But it's called Boomeroo.
Yeah. The island is called Waponiwoo. Okay, so this is where the shocked things come into play.
They're just throwaway words.
I mean,
they're garbage.
Like, it's gibberish.
Yeah.
So,
well, the natives call the volcano the Big Woo.
Yeah.
This is kind of like a vibranium
thing. Yeah, he needs his unobtainium to be able to make his shim-sham machines. Oh, he pulls out, a weird side note is he pulls out a pipe to smoke.
Mm-hmm.
Which, one, they smoke a lot of places in this film. Which is just weird because most tobacco stuff has been banned from a lot of the movies that have to do, especially with bigger movie production companies, right? But he pulls out what is called a scrimshaw pipe, which is a super fancy pipe. My dad gave me one from his collect. Like, he never collected them, but he had this one from a long time ago. And he's like, here's the thing. I'm giving you this pipe, but you can only hold it if you're wearing gloves. It's like a schmancy pipe. And this dude is just whipping it out of his pocket and smoking it. Like, these things can be worth hundreds of, if not thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
I Googled it once because I got one and I didn't know what to do with it.
Did you sell it?
No, it's in a box somewhere.
Okay. Save it for an emergency.
I'm going to put it on a hearth next to a duck sculpture.
And a walrus dong. That's a throwback to our first episode.
No. And a toaster.
These
natives won't give me the mineral rights. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing, since they only fish and like eat fruit, like I got nothing to give them, but they need something.
Yeah, they need someone to jump in the big volcano because that's like part of their culture.
They can't just throw somebody in, it has to be a willing participant.
Yeah. And so he pretty much is saying, since you only got like a few months to live.
I talked to your doctor.
Yeah.
He told me of your predicament.
Yeah.
I checked your money. I know you're broke.
Yeah. So how about you just go ahead and buy a bunch of stuff, take this one last trip, and, you know, just throw yourself in.
Look, it'll be a total red carpet situation is what he calls it.
Yeah.
And then dude just is like, all right.
Yeah, like the last line, he says, live like a king, die like a man, which is hilarious because this guy is like definitely living like a king, but he ain't dying like a man.
Well, he wants that unobtainium.
Right, right. So pretty much Joe gets like four different credit cards that he can go ahead and do whatever he wants.
Because in the next 20 days, because they only have to sacrifice a person every 100 years to this volcano.
Yeah.
And it's been 99 years, 11 months, and 11 days. So we're just going to assume that we've got
19
days.
Yeah.
If you want to know how bad I am at numbers, go to any of our episodes. Yeah. But he's just, all right, I'll do it.
Joe may have a tad bit of hypochondria now, but if you're feeling down during the current epidemic, we hope April's review of Joe versus the Volcano will lift your spirits, applauder. Thank you for beginning this month's epic quest through over 2 hours of this 1990 film's review, along with our conversational side quests and wince-worthy walkthroughs. Hey, this is your audio engineer and epic quester as far as the walls of my house go, Jen, wishing you a cabin fever-free April and beyond. Think you might have a friend who's looking for epic conversations at a lonely hour? Several of our reviews for films like Monty Python and the Holy Grail and Pan's Labyrinth are on Netflix this month. Why not watch or rewatch a film we've reviewed remotely with a friend? Then tag us with your own comments. You can reach us on Facebook at Shocked and Applaud and Twitter at Shocked Applaud. We'll be back in only 1 week with part two of our review. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.